I'm going to be talking about the nature of psychological change, process of change. And over 30 years of studies have consistently shown that the greatest contributing factor to positive outcome in psychotherapy is not any particular theory or technique, of course, much to the disappointment of those who would like theirs to be the one that is the winner, but what is the most, the strongest factor contributing to change in psychotherapy is bound to be something very elusive or elusively defined, which is the bond or relationship between the patient and therapist. So there's no theory or technique more powerful than the resonance, connection, and communication between the two people working together. The kind of space, which I'll be talking about today, the kind of space that seems crucial for psychological growth is a nonlinear space. It's not as it used to be thought of in Freudian times or earlier times, where there's like a doctor who is analyzing a patient, observing a patient, and then applying a specific technique or treatment in order to cure the patient. That's more of a sense of a division between a subject and an object. It really is more of a nonlinear space, more akin to what is implied by about space in the studies of psi phenomena or consciousness-related anomalies, or the space that's implied by in quantum theory, where the observer and the observed are inextricably connected in affecting and changing each other at every moment. So in a way, profound psychological change, change in very deeply ingrained patterns that begin to be formed from birth on, and in fact, perhaps even in the womb, the changing of these deeply ingrained patterns is almost an anomaly in and of itself. When you think of someone who has suffered, let's say, I'll use an extreme example, but someone who's suffered extreme physical or sexual abuse since childhood, when you think of the challenge that that is to that person to, as they grow up and become an adult, to form healthy relationships and a healthy sense of self, self-esteem, it is very, very difficult. But it has been found that even in cases of schizophrenia, and there are some renowned cases that have been written about the journey of patient and therapist who have been able to manifest a cure, a total cure of schizophrenia, simply by being in the healing relationship between patient and therapist. Now, I'll just mention for now what has helped the field of psychotherapy embrace this rather than focusing on simply technique is the advent of the popularity of intersubjective theory. So as I was saying before, in earlier times, it was thought that there was sort of a subject-object relationship, what was called a one-person psychology. But in the mid-80s, Stollerow, Atwood, Orange, Blanchard, people like that have really introduced a two-person psychology, where it is thought that each person, there's a field, an intersubjective field, a space, again, a nonlinear, non-locatable space that develops between patient and therapist, actually between any people, but we're sticking to the patient-therapist dyad right now, and that field itself becomes almost like a third aspect of the relationship between the two, and in turn, it influences what goes on in the therapeutic session. An example of this would be this quote from someone who said that it's known that Freudian patients have Freudian dreams and Jungian patients have Jungian dreams and so forth. So you can see how even the unconscious is affected by the field that's created between patient and therapist. Most of you may know of the, you know, some of the, for instance, the pair studies, but I'll just the ones that I'll refer to in making some of these parallels are the REG, the random event generator studies, where, of course, there are thousands of bits of data representing the ones and zeros produced by the machine, which should, the statistical expectation would be 50% of ones and 50% of zeros. But it was found that a number of operators or subjects were able to alter that statistically predictable outcome. Now, how was that possible? Of course, the specifics aren't known, but some of the things, as Brenda Dunn relayed to me many times, some of the things that were said by the more successful operators were that they kind of entered a third space with the machine. They allowed their identity to be blurred so that they did not feel such a differentiation between subject and object. And so there is some kind of a parallel there. Now, what's interesting too, and many of you may know this, but I will, it bears repeating, that two individuals who were coordinating their intention had a greater effect on altering the machine's output than each individual alone. And even more striking, two people who shared a particular emotional bond, a strong bond, had a 7 times greater effect on the machine's output. So there seems to be something about the resonance, attunement, you may even say love, between two people that seems to have something to do with altering what might otherwise be expected. And going back to what I said about the challenge to people in changing very, very powerful psychological patterns, in a way, what patient and therapists are trying to do is to change what would otherwise be the statistically predictable outcome of a person's life given certain things that occurred in childhood. So neuroscience has supported the idea that technique and theory are not the be-all and end-all for psychological change. Alan Shore, a neuropsychologist, has said that it is the right hemisphere to right hemisphere resonance that seems to be important in mother-infant communication and also in patient therapy. Of course, the right hemisphere being the side of the brain that's more associated. It's not so it's such a one-to-one correlation, but it's more associated with emotional understanding rather than logical, linear, verbal. And he says that all technique sits atop the therapist's ability to tap into the implicit or the unconscious realm. So I'm going to talk about a couple cases just to sort of illustrate how strange the space can be between patient and therapist. But before I do so, I want you to have a couple different models in mind about what might be happening. So we can look at unconscious communication in at least two ways. I'm just going to mention two. So Freud's idea, and by the way, Freud was fascinated by paranormal phenomena. He had to kind of back off from it because he was already trying to get Victorian society to accept that there was such a thing as infant and childhood sexuality. And I think he just couldn't take on too many taboos at once and wanted to protect psychoanalysis from the sort of mediums and table tappers that were popular at the time. But in 1921, in fact, he said that if he had his life to do over again, he would devote it to the study of psychical research rather than psychoanalysis. But so getting back to the two models that I want you to have in mind, Freud's idea of unconscious communication, I'll quote him. He said, "I have good reason for asserting that everyone possesses in his own unconscious an instrument with which he can interpret the utterances of the unconscious in other people." And in his speaking of telepathy, he said that it consists of a mental act in one person instigating the same mental act in another person. So in his mind, unconscious communication required some kind of signal transmitted from one mind to another. But another model to keep in mind may be exemplified more by the quantum concept of entanglement. Coming from the Bell's theorem, where two photons separated at a source seem to know instantaneously, know each other's spin and charge, and coordinate their properties instantaneously across thousands of miles. Einstein, of course, called this spooky action at a distance. Physicist Abner Shimoni, when he was reflecting on this phase, said he didn't like it because action, spooky action, would imply a transmission of energy or a signal. And it's known that a signal can't travel faster than the speed of light. So he decided jokingly to call this phenomenon passion at a distance. And I've kind of co-opted that term because I think that's sometimes what happens between patient and therapist. So I'm going to just talk of a couple cases, and you may kind of have in mind which of these models, there are probably more, but might apply. So the first one, I will call him Bill. And when Bill first came to see me, he came in an absolute rage, and he spent the entire session cursing and yelling, mainly about the women in his life. And he said he had a hit list. I didn't know how seriously to take him, but they were all women. And he looked at me and he said, "You might end up on this list as well," given that I was a woman. So he was a little scary. But as he talked in that session, this strange image came into my mind. And it was the image of Bill working very in this beautiful, beautiful flower garden. And he had this beatific smile on his face, totally incongruent for what was going on. And so I sort of pushed it out of my mind. But at the end of the day, I was thinking over the session, and I thought, well, probably that image just came to mind because, he was so scary, and maybe my mind grasped for a peaceful symbol so that I could, be better able to sort of stay with him in the session. But it still seemed strange to me because gardens are not, I'm not someone who's done gardening. If I were to think of a peaceful image or something that calmed me, probably would be the ocean or something like that. So it still seems strange. So as Bill and I continued working, this image just sort of stayed in my mind. After a while, it was outside of my conscious awareness most of the time, but it just had become a part of him, I think, in my mind, the way when you spend a lot of time with someone who wears glasses, sometimes you kind of don't notice the glasses anymore, even though you know that they're there. It's that kind of thing. So I worked with Bill for, I think it was 3 or 4 years, and we grew to develop quite a trusting relationship, and he made a lot of progress and changes in his life. We can't go into all the details now, but he really, his anger stopped getting in his own way, and for the most part. And then at a certain point, he had to move upstate, and so I didn't see him for quite a long time. It's probably after 2 to 3 years, I got a call from Bill, and he happened to be in Manhattan, and he asked me if he could, just stop by and say hello and see me. So I arranged the time. And he came and he sat down and we were talking. And then at a certain point, he took out his wallet and he said, "I have to show you something." And by the way, I'll just sort of underscore, I never mentioned anything to him about my image. For some reason, in that case, it didn't seem appropriate. I thought he was going to be taking out pictures of grandchildren or something like that. But he took out pictures, several of them, of this incredibly beautiful flower garden. And he told me that this had given him the most peace he ever had in his life. And it was something, and he joked, he said, "I bet you never would have thought I'd be doing something like this." Well, needless to say, I was quite stunned. I didn't say anything to him about my vision. But what happened there? Did I pick up early on? So was it a precognitive vision of mine? Was something about his desire and longing for peace and the capacity for gardening to bring that to him? Was that in his unconscious and as in Freud's model? I pick that signal up, and then that's one possibility. Another possibility is that existed already, and Bill and I both kind of tapped into it and related to it. But at very least, the main point I want to make is my having that image of him in my mind, and it's becoming, it's residing in my mind as a part of my experience of him, I do believe allowed me and shaped probably outside of my own awareness every minute that I was working with him, and allowed me to relate to a part of him that no one else probably related to, because he was so blustery and obnoxious at times. So I think that did shape the therapeutic experience. Now, in a moment, I'm just going to go through, you know, briefly another case, and then perhaps people will want to ask questions at that point, and then I'll continue after that. So the other case, this was a young man who came to me when he was 19, and he was from a very poor family, and grew up, and he happened to be African American, very poor, and his father had died suddenly when he was 10, and around 10. And the circumstances were, there was a car accident, and his father was killed instantly, and the person, I will call him Sam, Sam walked away basically, but, you know, barely injured. And his mother went into a very, very deep depression upon the death of the father, and there were three younger siblings. So at a very early age, Sam became the man of the house, and he, you know, worked his way through high school, but he was very bright, and he had aspirations to go to college, but that was out of the question. So when I saw him, he was working two jobs, one, a very, very grueling job in a chemical plant, and he had all kinds of skin problems from the allergies to the toxic materials. And then he also had another job, like at something like a Burger King or whatever. And he, because of his work schedule, it was very difficult for him to come to sessions. So I saw him infrequently, and not over a long period of time. And so I kind of, you know, wasn't thinking of this as something that would be, you know, a really in-depth psychoanalytic experience, but rather almost more, you know, so that he had some place he could go where he could talk about what was on his mind, almost a supportive kind of therapy is how I thought of it. Well, at one point, I had just an image of his, of these trophies, awards, medals, so in that category, they're all representative of that. And in this case, I don't know why, but I decided to ask him. Oh, one thing I should say, that he had no memory of anything prior to the accident where his father was killed. So it was very hard to kind of get a feel for what went on before that. So I asked him, I just said, gee, did you ever win any kind of a trophy or an award or something like that? And he kind of just kind of looked at me kind of quizzically. He said, no, I don't think so. But a couple weeks later, when I saw him next, he told me, he said, you know, I thought about that. And he said, I had totally forgotten about this because it happened prior to his father's death. He had been in third and fourth grade, he had been like a class artist. And in fourth grade, they remembered his teacher had submitted one of his art projects to a county contest, and Sam had won. Now, he had forgotten about it for two reasons. One, that the trauma of his father's death. We know that trauma can affect the hippocampus and the functioning of memory, and sometimes this is not uncommon when this happens. But also, I thought that he probably forgot that too, because remembering about his artistic talent and his reward for it made him have to de-idealize his dead father, because his father had been very contemptuous of this son who wanted to be an artist. So it did require him to kind of reconfigure some things about the father he remembered and wanted to stay, you know, close to in his mind. So anyway, this particular therapy did not last long because at some point, as I said, he came infrequently for sessions, and then at some point he moved. So I think I only saw him for maybe over a period of perhaps 8 months, 10 months. But about 5 years later, 5, 6 years later, I got a letter, and it was from Sam, and it was on the stationery with the letterhead of a graphics art company. In it, he told me that he had been working there for about a year, that he never forgot what we talked about his interest in art, and he somehow made his way into this company, and he had just been named something like Employee of the Month or Employee of the Year, so he wrote me about that. Now, before I have you, if anyone has questions, I just want to speculate, you know, how symbols play a role here. Now, I know that Bob and Brenda had sort of proposed some kind of a model whereby the human unconscious, which is not bound by time or space, which also operates in a very nonlinear fashion, may form some kind of an interface with the intangible world that is represented by quantum theoretical models. And that in that interface, it may be a possibility that some of the information or bits of information that occur in that sort of nonlinear, non-spatial space of the quantum world may have some kind of communication with the unconscious. So I thought when things like this happen, as with Bill and Sam and things like this happen a lot, I wonder if symbols and imagery might be some kind of a first order precipitate from that interface, so that the images may be almost like the particles of the unconscious that emerge from that interface. Okay, so at this point, I'd like to see if anyone has any questions before I speak more. Okay, I'm going to repeat the question. When Bill showed you the picture, were you able to find out from him if it was a new post-meeting picture or taken before you met him? Oh, good question. I'm sorry I did not make that clear. No, this was something that he just developed on his own after we had stopped working together, because he moved upstate where, you know, to a place where he could really do this elaborate garden, which, as far as I know, is not really possible in New York City. Okay. Were you able to help Sam open up his closed memory prior to the accident during your therapy with him? Did he recollect more? After he had the memory of the winning the award and the county award, then he did talk more, and it was very painful for him because he preserved his father in this kind of capsule that was immune to any kind of critical thought. He had to in order to just hold himself up from 10 years old on, sort of taking care of his younger siblings, his mother, his depressed mother, managing to get through high school. So he did start remembering the things that his father would say, and that his father was not always this wonderful person that he had remembered him to be. And that was difficult, but I think it helped him, it sort of helped dislodge him from the pattern that he was in. He had assumed that his whole life would be working in a chemical factory, Burger Kings, things like that. He had absolutely no hope that, and you know, frankly, I'm usually extremely optimistic in working with people, but I remember in the beginning working with him that even for me, I couldn't see how he could get out of the circumstantial trap that he was in. So So he did recall some more, especially what we spoke about was his relationship with his father. Okay, Douglas. I'm a therapist. I do bring up clients' potential for access to a higher power and make it a therapeutic goal. Do you? I do with some clients who are open to that. With others, I don't feel that it's useful sometimes for me to bring that up, because if there's not a receptor, what I do try to do is, though, from my own framework, which is a very expansive one and a very optimistic one, and one that is, you know, I was talking about before, the intersubjective field being a two-person psychology, I really think that that is too limited a model in and of itself. And I don't think today I have enough time to go into a much longer case that would illustrate this, but I do think that the patient-therapist intersubjective field is permeated by and influenced by the field of the larger space around it, and that it shares aspects of, even on a metaphoric, poetic level, aspects of the quantum world, in that patient and therapist are open at any moment through their interrelationship to a multitude, perhaps infinitude of possibilities that can occur. And that is addressing what you're talking about whether it's a higher power or a more expansive power that permeates the patient-therapist field. So I have that frame, I work from that framework. And what I find over time is that even if I don't bring up directly something with a client who may not want to be hearing that or talk about that, that it gradually, in that magical alchemical way that the intersubjective field works, often people whom I would never expect would be speaking about those things do end up speaking, and then we do work that way. So the answer is, for some patients I bring it up directly, others it may emerge from the possibilities of our intersubjective field, because I'm part of that intersubjective field. So, okay. Franklin. I'm working as a clinical hypnotherapist with energy psychology from a background. I'm sorry, I don't have the rest of your question there. So I'll go to the next question, and maybe you can retype your question in. I don't have the, all I have is I'm working as a clinical hypnotherapist with energy psychology from a background. Okay. Next question. What types of methods do you use during therapy to get yourself and the patient into consciousness synchronization? And does it always work? Have you found that some things / attitudes hinder this? Just very good question. Let me just think for a moment. You know, in terms of what methods I use, wrongly or rightly, I'm not a method person. So I would say, if anything, my method maybe emerges without my seeing it as a method. It maybe emerges from all the things that I try to do to expand my own consciousness. A variety of things that I do, not simply before I see a client, but on a just a general way in my life, that the more that I do, the more that I'm capable of consciousness synchronization, if I understand what you mean. And you may be talking also about, you know, an expanded form of empathy. And again, that may just be something that I develop, period. Does it always work? Again, not being a method person, I don't think there's any particular thing that that always works. I wish there were, but I think some things work better than others, and the thing that I find works better is that sort of just being in the space with the person in the most consciously and unconsciously alert way that one can be, and always having the best interests of the client or patient in mind, rather than the best interests of a theory or a technique or even a method. So your next part of your question, have you found that some things / attitudes hinder this? I think, you know, it's important to be sort of what I just said, as alert on a conscious and unconscious level as one can be. So what might hinder that might be if, you know, if I'm distracted by something or if my attention wavers for a moment, I'm sure that could hinder things, but I can't think of anything specific other than, you know, maybe some, you know, distractedness, which is inevitable at times. So it's, you just keep bringing yourself back into the focus and into the space with the person. I hope that answers your question. Okay, the next one. Over 35 years of practice, I have found your observation to be true about the connection between the people working together makes it possible to use almost any appropriate therapeutic tool successfully. Yes, I'm glad that you've experienced that. I think that's true. When people reify a particular technique or theory, rather than allow, I think techniques and theories are good, you know, they're sort of like a toolkit, right? But if you're holding on too tightly to, you know, whether it's the hammer or the screwdriver, you're likely to keep using that rather than being more fluid in the space and sort of adapting to what seems appropriate. Again, it's about those that kind of space from which anything can emerge in a nonlinear fashion. Because if we go by, you know, if we expect that people are going to sort of unfold linearly, I think that you know, that could take some people maybe 300 years, and life isn't that long. And so what I was talking about the sort of the, poetically speaking, the quantum space from which, you know, it said that from the quantum vacuum, right, there emerge these virtual particles that sort of pop in and out of existence. I think it's good to be open to those kinds of things when working with the patient, or going to the Buddhist concept of emptiness, emptiness being this, you know, it has no form or substance, and yet it is that which, from which emerges all form and substance. So leaving things open to these non-linear possibilities, I think, and that's, I think, Karen, what you're getting at as well. Franklin, okay. As a general practitioner for more than 30 years, my interest lies in communication and information understanding. What about the zero-point field as the interface? Do you know about matrix energetic, Richard Bartlett's matrix energetics? I'm sorry that I don't know about that. It sounds like something I would want to know about, but I don't. So I'm not going to be a good one to comment on that. Do you have anything else to say about that? Okay, let me, if you do, you can write that. I'll go on to Douglas. How do you employ the heart field? I use heart math. Do you believe it okay to tell a client that you love them in a healthy, professional manner, of course? I do. I mean, I think there are, again, everything is about the right moment. There are times when a patient might be feeling so awful about themselves or suicidal. And sometimes you would think that would be the best time to tell a patient that you love them, but sometimes it isn't, because you have to be aware, I think, of where they're coming from. And it's all about, do they have the receptors to receive what you're saying? But I certainly wouldn't rule out the helpfulness of, at times, letting a patient know. I mean, they're going to know from how you treat them, but letting a patient know verbally how much you care about them, how much they really mean to you. Okay. Is it more important for the patient to recollect fully the his past experiences, to identify fully with past experiences, or to non-linearly envision them happening differently and moving on and growing? Well, that's another really good question. You know, I know there's a lot of work that has to do with visualizing and sort of putting oneself, it's sort of exactly what you were talking about, having them visualize things happening differently and then sort of having the field, their own internal field, their own relationship with themselves shift and their own future shift in that way. But I have found that people vary, and people who have been really traumatized, I think, often seem to do better when they understand what contributed to their seemingly self-destructive strange behavior in the present. So an understanding and respect for the path that got them where they are seems to me to pave the way more for the kind of work you're talking about. But again, I don't like to generalize, because I think there are people who could more immediately go to the type of work you're talking about. But it's such an individual matter. Again, it's so particular to the field of that person's relationship to him or her own self that they bring into the room, and then the field that develops between you, and then those things that can happen serendipitously from whatever the larger field is beyond that. It's purely about intuitive communication. Yes, I think that's what the neuropsychologist Alan Shore meant when he said that all technique and theory sits atop the therapist's ability to access the implicit realm, and meaning, like he's talking about, in fact, he talks at other points about the importance of intuition. However, I do want to say, I present one caveat there. I think I'm a pretty intuitive person. However, I don't, now this could be my problem, but I don't totally trust or take that my intuition is always the conveyor of absolute truth, because I do think, as you know, many of you may have read the Filters book, maybe read my chapter, I do think that it's not impossible at all, but it's very difficult to think that your intuition could always be totally pure and uncontaminated by your own filters. So while I do think that is possible to reach that state, sometimes, you know, an intuition that you might have with a patient could be wrong. However, I think it's good to try out, you know, those intuitions, as long as you're not wedded to them as being absolute truth. Okay, Freud's protege, Wilhelm Reich, once quipped that a patient came to a psychoanalyst and paid him for a surety that nothing would change. How often do you come across coasters, no change wanted? You know, I think very, very rarely. I think I'm not a believer that people really want pain, or that people really want to stay where they are if where they are is painful. I think it has a lot to do with the inertia of the pre-existing fields that came about from their history, from their experience. You could think of also karmic, if you think of other lives as being contributing to that inertia. And as we all know, it's a look, Even not talking about serious problems like abuse childhood trauma, if you just think of what it takes for, you know, someone to want to lose weight or stop smoking cigarettes, they can really want to do that. But the momentum of the and the weight of the inertia of these fields and patterns, I think. So I don't tend to look at it that way. I mean, maybe occasionally that would be the case, but I think, again, if you yourself as the therapist are really optimistic and really feel that, you know, there's a lot of fluidity, a lot of possibility for change, I think that's going to affect in some way even the most daunting coaster, I'm saying. I'm just going to say now one other, well, this goes way back, but it's sort of on our topic of how the bond, attunement, you know, something that's way beyond our awareness, like the successful operators with the REG machines, they could just sort of, you know, use words to approximate what they were doing. But I'm sure they didn't really know what they were doing because, as Alan Shore said, so much of it is on an implicit unconscious level in that. So, I'm just reading what Frank said and then I'll continue. Agree with your caveat. Did I miss someone else's? Yes, I did. Right. I'm just going to just quickly talk about this series of experiments. They're really kind of outdated, but I think it's still relevant to our topic. There was a series of experiments from the 1970s and 1980s that I think really underscores the change-affecting potential of these, what I'm calling these kind of merged states, which I think is what was indicated by the REG operator relationship, by the patient-therapist relationship, by mother-infant relationships, or caretaker infant. So these experiments were designed to find out if some subliminal messages of oneness, of merging with an important figure, in this case the mother, would have a healing effect on adult psychopathology, specifically on schizophrenic patients. And the method used, well, it's a complicated name, I don't have to go into that, but patients were exposed to certain messages through flashes of a tachistoscope at such a high speed that nothing more than a flicker of light could be consciously perceived. Now, in one study, schizophrenic patients were given subliminal exposures of the message, "Mommy and I are one," while the control group received a neutral message such as, "People are walking." Now, in the group that received the "Mommy and I are one" message, there was a significant decrease in pathological symptoms that did not occur in the controls. In subsequent studies, this is kind of interesting, contrasted the effect of the "Mommy and I are one" message with other comforting statements such as, "Mommy feeds me," "Mommy is always with me," "Mommy is inside me," "Mommy and I are the same," "Mommy and I are alike," etc. Now, the results, I think, were really compelling. Only the message, "Mommy and I are one," was correlated with a reduction in both pathological thinking and pathological behavior. The other messages showed no difference from the controls, with no change in pathological symptoms. So this is speculation, but the conductors of the study, and I like this speculation myself, that although comforting, those other statements still created more of a sense of a separate subject and object. So there seems to be something where there's more of an effective transportation of change-inducing information when there are states of real attunement, even maybe merging. Okay, so now I'll go back to your questions. Okay. All right, have you worked with someone presenting with multiple personality disorder or dissociative personality disorder? If you have, what is your opinion on the discussion in the profession? If it is a real, the best, I'm not sure what that says. I worked with someone once who was a psychologist, and his practice specialized in multiple personality disorder. I worked with schizophrenics, but not really what, you know, I would call multiple personality disorder. So I'm not sure when you said, what is my opinion on the discussion in the profession? You know, there's so many aspects of the discussion. Some people, as I'm sure you know, since you're asking that question, really believe that is how, that is the only way that someone who undergoes such horrendous trauma can deal with it. And then there is the possibility in the framework of a healing relationship with a therapist to integrate that and to have sort of main, it's like having an orchestra without a conductor. We all have, you know, different instruments or different personalities, but we usually have a conductor so we can integrate things and we can actually go through our lives even with the many different facets. So I do think it's possible to bring those personalities together and have a main. I think the conductor is absent in these people because if they are one solid person, they can more easily be killed or attacked. So I don't know if that answers your question. Franklin says, I agree with your caveat. It's always a matter of working together on a horizontal level between two human beings. Yes. Okay, Shantam Nijama always stresses that a man cannot grow unless if he kills the inside his mind. I'm sorry. Is it easy for you to recognize a self-created super parent in the energy field of a patient? I think I would need to understand more what your question is. I think I might understand it. Sort of a higher self or a self that can kind of go out and be like a forward observer and see what is possible and lead the self toward that. If that's what you are saying, then I would say, yes, I actually try to almost have that aspect of self grow and develop. Douglas says, do you engage in any community activism, using the collective unconscious to promote widespread change? How might we promote the shift of 2012? Well, that's a really good question. As for the only community activism that I would say I engage in, and maybe it's not quite that, is I'm trying to bring discussion of the actual ramifications of the studies in psi phenomena, such as the ones done at the Pear Lab and others, to the mainstream psychological field. And I, in the last few months, have given 3 lectures at a psychoanalytic institute and have kind of broached some of these things and have been really heartened by how relatively well, with a few exceptions, they were received. In terms of promoting the shift of 2012, I don't know what to say about that. The only way, this may be pretty pathetic, but the only way I see to do that is, to kind of keep expanding, my own consciousness and then using that to help others in a very small, perhaps a very small circle. But when a child gets scolded by parents and has to create a parent inside his or her own mind so to stop the actual physical parents from scolding, he'd be rated by himself, herself, without the parent's presence. That's what meant by super parent. Oh. Yeah, well, in the way I look at it, let's say from a therapeutic standpoint, what you're talking about is this is just from my perspective, I don't necessarily mean that's exactly what you were talking about, but I think of it in terms of what we think of as this, we often think of the superego in analytic terms as, superego sort of, keeps us from lying and killing and things like that, which otherwise our id might have us do. I think of the superego in working with many patients as different from that. I feel the superego is something that needs to be actually gotten rid of because it's usually an amalgam of the very kinds of voices that the scolding voices of parents or other kind of very, very negative self-annihilating voices that masquerade as a legitimate superego. And so I sometimes work speaking directly to the patient's superego. I have them speak from that place, and then often I get into quite some very interesting combats with the way I'm using the superego. And then to go back to your question, that sort of super parent, and super parent actually I would see more in the way I'm speaking of it as the patient's own self finally able to come alive and emerge and have its own voice and be able to say to that superego, that negative superego, you know, get out of here, I'm not listening to you. And for a while, it's as if the therapist becomes the auxiliary ego for the patient until the patient can do that for himself. So I think we're sort of talking about the same thing. I just kind of have a different filter, I guess, for it. Any other questions? For now, it's interesting. In one of the talks that I gave recently, as I said, this group of psychiatrists, psychoanalysts were quite open, but I became aware of how, you know, we who are here right now in this chat room, we may be speaking a language that is not that common, because one of the analysts who was very open to my talk, she was really struggling with that concept that I gave. She's really on the page with intersubjectivity theory, with the patient therapist being creating this field that isn't, that where subject and object are not really so distinguishable, and that change emerges from there. But when I brought up this kind of sense of a superordinate field, in other words, that you can't think of the psychoanalytic or psychotherapeutic patient therapist dyad as, you know, having a fence around it or being cordoned off from whatever else, you know, sort of engenders that kind of space or even the unconscious. That was where a few people had, they really wanted to, but they had trouble really envisioning that. It could have been a failure of my way of explaining it, but I'm just sort of saying that we're in our own chat room sometimes, but okay. Is this kind of talking to the superego within something that a patient can do solo, or should there always be a secondary person for the two-person connection? Can solo go wrong? Really good question. I have found that when I have spent enough time combating, it's very interesting when I do that, it's like the patient, him or herself, I'm talking to the superego and we're having a fight, right? And it's like the patient is watching like a tennis match. You know, the patient is talking as their superego, but they're also observing. And right there, that is the first step toward healing, because they've managed to separate themselves from that amalgam of all the negative voices. Now, you're asking, can solo go wrong? I think if you're meeting regularly with the person, what I do is I encourage the person then to carry on the fight when they're not with me, or to hear what I would say when those voices come in. And actually, it's a good way of working with certain, and I would hate to generalize on this, but schizophrenics, borderline, which seems to be very helpful. Hi, Vasilios. How are you? Hi, Ruth. Remembering Jung's and Pauli's historic collaboration on the natural basis of telepathy and synchronicity. What is the situation now? So could there be a window of opportunity in opening anew the discussion between physics and psychiatry, or taboos still hold strong in both fields? Oh, that's, you know, my last talk at the Psychoanalytic Institute was on psychoanalysis and quantum physics, of course, speaking quantum physics and poetic metaphors, although I do keep in mind that it was Niels Bohr who said that there was a parallel between the indistinguishability of subject and object in psychological context, or the difficulty distinguishing them, and the difficulty distinguishing observer from observed in the physical world. But anyway, people were really, really interested. In fact, they may be wanting some kind of an ongoing thing. But that's, I think, in a way, psychoanalysts are thought of as very, you know, antiquated and stodgy in many ways. But in other ways, they're more on the same page with what we're talking about, if they're, you know, open-minded. They're more on the same page, because once you believe in an unconscious and that most of our behavior, thoughts, inclinations are governed by things that are beyond our awareness, beyond our ability to really explicitly verbalize, then you're already in sort of the same chat room that we're in right now. But I think there's an openness. I think in general, what I've heard from my students at psychology students at Columbia, that not only are these things not sanctioned so much, but they're saying that anything, even in just talking about psychology and therapy, some of them said that mine was the only course that really dealt with in-depth clinical work. The orientation now is toward, you know, proving things with research and evidence-based practice and things like that. So I think it's scattered. I wish I had a better answer for you. Are patients somehow so open that you go through the patient, through the superego, to transhuman collective consciousness pain? How to identify when it is patients, when it is global? How to disconnect? Oh, that is a beautiful question. You know, sometimes I get a feel that what someone is going through really, that it's someone who is very, very sensitive or open to things. You know, like I said, there's no fence around any of us, certainly. But some people have better defenses than others. And that occurs to me. And some people who themselves feel that way, we work overtly with that in mind. However, another caveat here is there are people who come in and I would say misuse that notion by then, instead of taking responsibility for their own evolution and their own transformation, they sort of see that everything is sort of, well, this is happening because of what's happening on the planet, or this is happening because, you know, of these other things outside. And that's the very same thing as working with a patient who keeps, let's say, getting fired from jobs and says, well, you know, it's my mother's fault, or it's my, you know. So that's, I think, something that is a real possibility. And that's why I say I think definitely your question is really valid. But I also find the other side of it, where I have to kind of draw someone away from that, because it just tends to keep them from what the work that they need to do to actually transform. Brenda, Vasilios's question. When physicists and psychiatrists can recognize that they're talking about the same thing, only using different language, they will be able to establish an intersubjective bond. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is beginning to happen. At least I see that beginning to happen with some of the talks that I've given, in trying to, you know, to use an old term for a different topic, sort of consciousness raising. And you said it perfectly. In fact, when I started, you know, one of these talks, I said that, you know, physicists and psychoanalysts are dealing with, you know, similar challenges, which is to kind of, you know, with physicists, it's, you know, how do things move? You know, where is that? There's no line between the micro world and the macro world, but how does information get from one to the other? And what, you know, what can we learn about that? And with psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, it's really the unconscious. You know, we're always looking for the derivatives from the unconscious, but we don't know exactly, you know, and we're trying to get more of that to kind of come over to be useful. So it's a very similar kind of thing, where you're dealing with these nonlinear, these, you know, getting information in a way that isn't the way we usually think of getting information. So it is very, very similar kinds of challenges. And there's no, you know, in neither one, whether it's the line between the unconscious and conscious, or the line between the micro and macro worlds, there's no sign, like when you're driving and it says you are now entering Texas. You know, so I don't have time to go into this case now, but often it seems when I'm working with someone, especially someone who's very, very rigidly attached to his or her patterns, that's when I really look for things that have nothing to do with the childhood patterns. You know, I really try to be alert. Let's say, if I, this wouldn't be the best example, but if you go back to the Sam thing, the guy, you know, the young man who worked in the chemical plant. I mean, to me, working in a psychodynamic way about, you know, his childhood and everything, I didn't think that would really be that direct what was going on in his life. So what did end up being relevant, or seemingly so, was this catching something that came from, I think, a kind of nonlinear space, that sort of emergence out of the Buddhist emptiness, or the virtual particles out of the quantum vacuum, or the, you know, unconscious that emerges nonlinearly sometimes from, you know, sort of not relevant to what one is paying conscious attention to. So that would be one, but there are others that I just don't have time to go into today, where it seemed to me, you know, when you were talking about the other kind of consciousness or the transhuman, going back to that superordinate field that permeates the patient therapist field, it seems that there are things that happen mind-bogglingly beyond patient therapist's conscious control, but that come in to kind of almost aid the work and progress the work. And sometimes synchronicities seem to function in that way. Some body work techniques stress the need to open up lower body energy blockages in order to release old material from the basement, similar to Carl Jung's shadow self. Is verbal always required? I think body work and body awareness is essential. You know, even Freud said that, you know, it's that we have a body ego. And he started his work, you know, looking at sort of, you know, psychosomatic symptoms and trying to trace them back to their origin, and then sort of getting both mind and body integrated. So I think that both are important, and for some people, the balance of importance is more toward the verbal, and for others, the balance is more toward the body. But I really believe we have a mind and a body for some reason, and to emphasize one or the other to the exclusion of one or the other is not going to work as well in terms of transformation. I work with people, I don't do actual body work, but I'm also a certified biofeedback therapist, so I work with people that way sometimes, but also with most of my therapy patients, at some point or another, depending on their need, but I will teach them various kinds of breathing. And it's not simply to improve their breathing and, you know, reduce anxiety, balance the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. It's also the awareness that comes about when they start really being able to bring their minds into their bodies, as certain breathing techniques incline people to do. So I think both are really important, and to leave one or the other out doesn't do us justice. What do you envision enabling a more potent connection between human beings on this planet? Apart from the internet and computer-based communication, of course. No, that's a great question. I wish I had a vision that I felt worked. You know, when you mention the internet and computer-based communication, I know we're benefiting from that right now, and we all benefit from it, and it makes things easier. But I was actually surprised to hear in both my classes at Columbia, these are, you know, 20, 19, 20-year-old people, unsolicited by me, I was really dismayed in a way. I thought it was just me being like a from the dinosaur era, who felt this way. But these kids were talking about how, with all the texting and the, you know, iPhones and this and that, that they feel more isolated, they feel less connected, and they feel there's this pressure to connect, but it leaves them feeling sometimes empty. So I'm confused now about whether the the direction we're going with all the technology is actually achieving a kind of connection that I think we're talking about today. I'm not sure. I'm a bad one for that. I don't have, I will stop speaking because I don't think I have anything of value to say. Sorry, I wish I did. I think, you know, the more people who really try to expand their consciousness so that they are open to real profound connection, I think that helps. But, you know, we do have several billion people on the planet, and for me that's a daunting number to have a coherent vision about. Okay, regards, Bill. What other pointers would you like to share patients who are in a constant state of anger, abrasiveness, disconnectedness, and looking for ways to judge, hate others? Another great question. Well, the first thing is, and for me, this is easy to do. I genuinely feel this way. It's not something I have to really, you know, think so much about. I assume that, you know, I'm sure there are exceptions, but in most cases, that when someone is that much in that much of a rage and hating, underlying that is some profound pain. So I think automatically, almost unconsciously for me, my antenna are out for, you know, what is the underlying pain here? How can I help this person trust the space he's in with me enough to allow themselves to go beneath that protective, defensive anger and start speaking about what's really hurting? And that's my first step. And the second one is, to not react from your own background to their particular anger, you know, to not be intimidated by it. The first step makes that easier. I have a rule with my patients, which is anything short of physical violence is allowed. And then they feel comfortable. They don't have to keep asking, is it okay if I say this or call you this or whatever. I don't know if that helps, but I have found, in the case of Bill, who you bring up, that is what happened. It turned out that something rather, you know, horrifying happened to him when he was 9 years old, and he hadn't been able to tell anyone. And so usually there, it may not be one thing that's happened. It could be just an atmosphere. And learning how that anger really preempts someone from achieving their goals and illuminating to them what, you know, their own goals, that helps too. So how come does it seem to be that certain humans who are more in their body need to be more in their mind, and others who are too much in their mind need to be more in their body? Well, I think the short answer to that is that achieving ideal balance, I think, is difficult for all of us, that we all tend to stay with what we're used to. So if we're used to being in our minds and that's our filter, you know, someone's got to shake us up to remind us that we have a body. Or if we're used to denying the importance of the mind and the importance of the left brain, then, you know, someone may need to, you know, shake. If you think of it in terms of chakras, you know, some people, you know, when people do go through sort of a balancing the chakras, that's sort of part of it too. Some people are sort of more stuck in their lower chakras, others in, you know, there's some people, again, I think I was referring to this indirectly before, who come in a very, very spiritual. You might think of that as a seventh chakra being very open, but nothing is working in their lives in a functional way. And so they're, you know, they need grounding. Okay, yes, I think I have to go now too. But thank you everyone for listening to me, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope to have more conversations in the future.